KALW.
Once the contestants are chosen, they gather in a house and they will spend a month writing together.
Today, we hear about a new kind of reality show.
American Idol, but for writers.
Then we'll hear readings from three Bay Area authors that show the breadth of nature books.
A particular type of ecological philosophy.
Between exposure and vitality.
Fighting to protect our national parks from political sabotage.
And an illustrator talks about her artwork in the DC comic series Poison Ivy.
The thing that I can compare it most to is like the terribly sublime. It's like things that are so wondrous and beautiful in a way that it's almost horrifying.
Writers and books from around the Bay. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Grant Faulkner believes we all have a story to tell. His nonprofit is National Novel Writing Month, which is also known as NaNoWriMo. It gets people of all ages to commit pen to paper. He's written two books on writing and co-founded the literary journal 100 Word Story. One of his current projects involves bringing the writing process to reality TV. He's now the executive producer of the show America's Next Great Author, where contestants will write furiously and compete to get their books published. I talked with Grant to learn more about this novel idea.
The story of the show goes way back, kind of many years. And it started with David Henry Sterry and Ariel Ekstedt, the book doctors. And they do this super cool, engaging event called Pitchpalooza. What happens is the people really pack in and they put their name in order to pitch their story in 1 minute. And then they get up in front of this audience, and it's nerve-wracking to some, and it's a moment to glory in their performative abilities for others. And at the end of the night, they award a winner, and the winner is introduced to an editor, an agent, and, you know, the paths of publishing are open to them. David had heard many people tell him, you should turn this into a reality TV show, American Idol, but for writers. And so we decided, hey, you've got this great event, Pitchapalooza. I have a lot of experience working with writers through National Novel Writing Month, and I know that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people with a story to tell.
All right, so let's talk about format. We know reality TV by now, from the days of MTV's Real World, and then, you know, Big Brother, and there's food contests, there's makeup contests.
There's everything but a show about writing, actually.
Hey, I mean, yeah, there's a need. But how do you decide then on a format?
Mm-hmm. We're going to travel to six American cities, and we're going to hold these Pitchapaloozas, these events. And the winner of each Pitchapalooza in each city gets invited to be a contestant on the show. And this is when, so that's the American Idol, but for writers part. The Real World, but for writers part, is that once the contestants are chosen, they gather in a house, a fantastic house, an inspiring house, and they will spend a month writing together. So, and living together. So there's drama in the living together, like the Real World, and a lot of drama in the writing together.
So who is the audience for this show? I mean, this is a reality show. It's a writing reality show. Who is it, writers that you're targeting, or who do you want to watch this?
There's a huge audience just of writers, you know, but I oftentimes, when I invite people to do National Novel Writing Month, I'll hear people say, I'm not a creative type. Mm. And we are all creative types. That's the definition of being human. We are all storytellers. That's the way we make meaning in the world. And so this is all about, this show is largely about gate crashing. We want to open up those gates to stories that either people aren't giving themselves permission to write, or our culture at large isn't giving them permission to write, or there's just not a pathway for that story to be seen and read in the world. It's like, I want the contestants to be so inspiring that they empower a lot of other people to say, hey, that could be me. Mm.
Okay, going to be honest here a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, as somebody
be honest, please.
As somebody who does watch reality shows, you know, there seems to be a certain personality or character that ends up being kind of on the show. And it's people who, that they're extroverted, some are kind of hams. And writers, you know, there's this stereotype of being secluded and quiet and even hermit-like, maybe.
Where did that start? You know, where how did that start?
Hey, I mean, there's this image, right, of the writer, of the author. Do you think putting writers in a limelight on TV will inhibit their writing process?
So, one, I've met a lot of extroverted writers, very performative writers. I was just at a reading last night with my co-executive producer, Kwame Alexander, who's also going to be a host on the show. And I am sure he has these very solitary, introverted moments of writing in his life, but he is also a super funny, engaging, performative guy. Writers are like all people. They come in every different shade of personality, you know, and some of them are more extroverted than others and more, you know, seeking the limelight and performance oriented. But, you know, it's really about, I think like any good casting for any show is about having a lot of different types of people. And so, sure, I think an introverted person can be compelling and engaging just in a different way. And so, you know, the show is going to have, it's not just going to be people sitting in their, you know, their cubbies writing. We're going to have a lot of different types of writing challenges and activities and games that liven things up.
You mentioned the host, Kwame Alexander, also involved, like we said, Jason Reynolds. And so, you know, there's some blackness in this show. There's some diversity definitely in this show. And I'm wondering if also, like, at the back of your minds or at the forefront, you were thinking, what role can this show play in diversifying the publishing industry and increasing the number of writers of color? And so I'm wondering what role you think this show can play in, you know, tackling that.
Yeah. It's you know, at the heart of our mission to bring diverse voices onto the show and to showcase them and to feature them and support them. And what you said is absolutely true. You know, there's this perception of late that the publishing industry is only or primarily publishing writers of color. And I just read a statistic, 75% of the books published last year were published by white people.
Yeah.
And I think publishing has just traditionally been, had a lot of systemic racism just embedded in every part of its process, really. So I think that this show and is part of a lot of other efforts going on to correct that.
So they're living together in a house, they're competing, the drama is happening. What does the winner get?
So the winner gets a publishing contract. That is the end goal. And so we're not actually picking a winner. This isn't a show based on elimination. This is a show based on, like, it's like a baking show in that sense, or the Great British Bake Off, where we're trying to showcase and shine on people's, like, abilities and capabilities. And so
just books instead of cake.
Just books instead of cake. There you go. That can be our tagline. You made it up. The goal is just to publish everybody's book. You actually put it into the world, and to be able to show part of that publishing process too. I mean, that's another educational component of the show. Is like the way that a book published is so mysterious to most writers, even writers who've gotten the book published. There's so much to learn about that, and so we hope we can kind of teach people about that part too.
Grant Faulkner is a writer and executive producer of the upcoming show, America's Next Great Author. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. When it comes to great American authors, our local writers are among the best. So today we're bringing you readings from our series New Arrivals, a pocket-sized book tour with Bay Area authors. We're featuring three very different books that explore the relationships between humans and nature. One, a beautiful field atlas, one, a novel about friendship, and one, a new vision for the National Park Service. We start with Obi Kaufman, a naturalist, writer, and illustrator who lives in Crockett. His book, The Coasts of California, is the latest in his Field Atlas series. It came out in April.
These atlases are filled with my paintings and my cartographic designs that describe a particular type of ecological philosophy that is inexorably tied to geographic literacy. By mapping a particular quality of California, I further engage in my personal, lifelong endeavor to be finally ever more from this place. The words we use to describe the future world are the waves against the beach. Although we can roughly measure the physical characteristics of each wave, our perspective is hopelessly individual. The context for the language we employ to tell this future story is the eroding shore. Prone to landscapes and earthquakes, the narrative itself adapts to the landscape as it radically shifts in a moment. The history of our changing story, a parade of endless revolution between only fleeting moments of homeostasis, is a fast crumbling cliff and a slow rising mountain.
That was Obi Kaufman reading from The Coasts of California. Now we move from maps and paintings of the coast to a novel about rock climbers in the Eastern Sierra. The book, called Native Air, was written by San Francisco author John Howland and published in April.
Native Air is about friendship, obsession, and grief. Set mostly in California's Eastern Sierra, the novel explores the relationship many of us experience between exposure and vitality. The narrator, Joe, is a reflective, ruminating type, as in this passage from an early part of the book. An only child, I was too frequently reminded, several times by a Sunday school teacher, that others of my mother's pregnancies had failed, both before I got here and after. Life in our circle was fragile and deeply contingent. The grace of God underlay everything. When I discovered climbing in college, I found the exposure and mortal perils thrilling, but also profligate and unforgivable. Early on, I'd make bargains, just this, then no more. To domesticate the dangers, I began to think of climbing as a kind of meditation or even prayer, but I never got far from wondering whether I'd fallen under some perversion of faith, some dark and disfiguring spirit whose most avid embodiment was, of course, Pete. In the past year, I'd sent postcards to several seminaries and divinity schools and made more than a little noise about making a move.
That was author Jonathan Howland reading from his novel Native Air. Now, in this last excerpt, we're going to hear from a former director of the National Park Service, John Jarvis, who lives in Pinole. He and his brother Destry, who's a conservationist, dig into the history of the National Park Service, and they propose a new vision for the organization's future. Their book is called National Parks Forever, and it came out in May. Here's John.
We tell our stories over the last 50 years of fighting to protect our national parks from political sabotage. We call for the National Park Service to be made an independent federal agency. This following excerpt sums up the situation of our national parks. The places and stories of America in the care of the National Park Service are too important to the nation, to our high ideals, and to future generations to be subject to the whipsaw of Washington's politics. We have witnessed proposals to turn the parks over to the private sector, ban all references to evolution, increase fees without public involvement, and carve Donald Trump's face onto Mount Rushmore. The National Park Service cannot possibly preserve, unimpaired the natural and cultural areas of the system while being overruled, second-guessed, threatened, and/or ignored by political appointees who control its every decision, personnel change, and budget request. While one might suggest that this is just the way it is with each change in administration, these changes actually impact the overarching mission of the National Park Service, to preserve the national parks unimpaired for the enjoyment of future generations.
That was John Jarvis reading from his book, National Parks Forever. New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. In our last segment, we heard about nature lovers from all walks of life, and some of them can be fictional. Poison Ivy is a popular character from the Batman comics. She's a biochemist with the ability to control plants. Ivy loves the planet and despises people. Because of her extreme views of replacing humanity with plant life, she's considered a villain and an anti-hero. South Bay illustrator Jessica Fong is the cover artist for the current Poison Ivy comic series. Her art is described as the terribly sublime, a form of surrealism that's horrifying yet beautiful. KALW's Janae Darden spoke with Jessica about her artistry.
Your art is just so beautiful and just so amazing. When did you take up an interest in art?
I just know that from childhood, visual input was like the way that I best interpreted the world. So I would say as far back as I can remember, I remember just being attracted to how things would like appear and look. And, you know, later, like, as you get older, you, like, develop those skills as to, like, how to put those images onto paper or, you know, sculpture or whatever. Yeah.
I read an article, an interview you did, and you talked about experiencing some abuse at home in your youth with a parent. How did art help you get through that?
So I think, at least from when I was young, it was kind of hard to be introspective. Just because you don't have those like tools and nobody kind of teaches you how to look inward like that when you're so young. And when you're making things or doing things, sometimes you don't really know where those things come from. But I guess when I was young, you know, you are kind of drawn to things that you like and you're not really sure why. So, you know, I drew characters that kind of looked like me going on these adventures, going on these like fantasies. And it wasn't until high school where, you know, I had this huge breadth of work that I'd been kind of working on privately. And my art teacher at the time saw that breadth of work and he was like, there's something there that you like need to explore, you know, emotionally and internally. And that's kind of when I noticed like, oh, I kind of put these characters through tribulations and obstacles. And, you know, you start to see parallels of all of these stressors in your life needing an outlet. I think moment to moment, a lot of people don't realize how all-inclusive the creation and art process is. Like, you're drawing on your memories, your experiences, the things around you, you know, just your brain's like collectively grabbing all of those things and putting it into your work, and you might not even like consciously know how much of that is going into the work. So I like to say like art is your brain working and making connections.
You are the cover artist for DC Comics' Poison Ivy series, which is a iconic villain. This is a dream job for a lot of artists. And so for people who don't know, let me backtrack. Poison Ivy is... Some people may say she's a misunderstood villain. she is the extreme environmentalist, and she wants to destroy humanity because of how we treat the earth. And she's a scientist. She's brilliant. She has a science background. And she has powers. And Uma Thurman played her years ago in a Batman movie. But
I love that depiction, by the way. Uma Thurman's depiction.
Yes. Okay. And definitely the costume. Mm-hmm. What was your relationship with the character prior to... and also, too, she's also bisexual. So she's environmentalist, queer, really brilliant woman.
I think you just described all the reasons why I liked her before working on the project. You know, like you see her on the screen or you read about her and you're like, I feel a kinship to, you know, some of the feelings she has around other people, around, you know, world issues and just who she is, like identity wise, like who she connects with in terms of relationships, friendships, you know, lovers. Like it just, I think that was my relationship with her beforehand is like, you know, she's one of the characters that I, you know, feel a kinship to.
Your drawings have an aesthetic, you know, like it's, I'm looking at this Poison Ivy and I see cyberpunk, I see dark fantasy. I haven't seen her drawn like this before. What inspired this style? She's a little scary too.
When we first started working on this and I was talking to the editor, Ariana Totoro, she mentioned all of these themes that I'm like, oh yes, this clicks. You know, there's body horror, there's surrealism, the dark fantasy. And I think the thing that I can compare it most to is like the terribly sublime. I don't know if people are like super familiar with that term. It's like things that are so wondrous and awe-inspiring and like kind of beautiful in a way that it's almost horrifying. And like it's supposed to call on like human struggle with, and I think Poison Ivy embodies this really well, kind of this struggle of like her humanity and her connection with people versus, you know, her responsibilities to like the larger world. And that already is like something that has been in my work before, like surrealism, like what does it mean to be this soul in a, you know, container? So I wanted that to kind of come across in the work is like you see all this fungi and plant life growing in and out of, you know, and around Poison Ivy. So, you know, she always has had that kind of internal battle of her devotion to plant life and, you know, the environment versus like her humanity and the container that she's kind of been born in.
You know, fandom and geek culture can be fun and toxic, especially for women. And I know you attend cons and again, I know Poison Ivy is such an iconic character. How are people treating you and receiving your work?
On a whole, it's been very positive. My wife and I have been kind of like gremlins during isolation, and we've, you know, wanted to be a part of our local community and like the queer community more closely. And working on Poison Ivy has kind of opened a lot of doors and like been able to at least help me like overcome some confidence, you know, and just internal struggles with wanting to be out there more and feeling kind of accepted and wanted. And I would say that the response to Poison Ivy's release, like it's a lot more than I expected. You know, I felt in the beginning that like, oh, this is just something really, really cool that I relate to. And it's really great to work on it. And I wasn't expecting, you know, things in return, I guess. And that's been really good, a lot to kind of take in.
That was illustrator Jessica Fong speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. That interview was co-produced by Porfirio Rangel. Jessica's having a signing event at New Elusive Comics and Games in Santa Clara this October 5th. All the details are at KALW.org.
Late at night while you're sleeping,
Today's Cross Currents team includes Mary Catherine O'Connor, Wendy Reyes, James Rollins, Gabe Graben, Victor Tenz, Shirin Adel, Sunni Khalid, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.